talked about the problems with Back to Godhead, publishing that article, and Prabhupada's comments about Satyam Bruyat, Priyam Bruyat. So now we'll look at another problem that arose with one of the devotees who had been writing. There was an Indian devotee, his name was Anantaram Shastri. So he had joined, I think, in 74 or 75 with some other Shastris. But the three of them had left, and he was just left over there in Mayapur when Prabhupada came there in 1976. So on January the 25th, 1976, Prabhupada was walking on his morning walk, and he was joined by Anantaram Shastri. Srila Prabhupada expressed his satisfaction that such an educated man has joined our movement, and he instructed Bhavananda Maharaj to make sure that he is well looked after so that he may not go away. Although a somewhat self-conscious individual, Shastriji was eager to recite a poem that he had composed for Srila Prabhupada's pleasure. As we walked, and without asking first, he broke out into melodious verse, singing the praises of Bhagavan Sri Gopal, or at least it seemed so. His chanting was impressive to my untrained ear, but Srila Prabhupada was alert. When Shastri sang, "Nachiye, Nachiye, Aile Gopal," "My dear Gopal, please come to me dancing," Prabhupada stopped him. "Do not manufacture knowledge. Take knowledge from Bhagavan. Do not order Bhagavan. Just follow Bhagavan. That is not wanted. Do not write concocted poetries. That is not beneficial. Simply follow." Srila Prabhupada told him that his singing was sense gratification because he was giving an instruction to Gopal. "Please come to me, Nachiye, dancing." He stressed that our process is to take instruction. "It is all nonsense. Why you should ask Gopal to come to you? You cannot order, you must follow. We are to carry out the order of God, not to order God to carry out my order. That is a mistake." Prabhupada went on for some time condemning the attitude with which people generally approach God. He explained that in India, they sing a traditional arati song which repeats the words "Sabko Sampati De Bhagavan." "De Bhagavan" means "give me." And in the West, he explained, the Christians also have the same idea. The whole world, Prabhupada observed, they have... Excuse me. They have accepted God as order supplier. I order and you supply. The Christian church also, "God give us our daily bread." And if God doesn't give, then God is dead, Tamal Krishna Maharaj added. Yes, dead, Prabhupada said. This is going on. And our prayer is, "I don't want anything. Simply engage me in your service." That is the real prayer, which is taught by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So anyway, this man Shastri actually was very expert at Sanskrit. He was, as his name implies, he was a real scholar. He could quote practically any verse, you know, from memory. So he stayed around for a little while longer. Prabhupada actually had him travel with us, with his party, from Mayapur to Vrindavan. But then when we left Vrindavan and went to Bombay, and then from there we went on the last world tour, then Shastri was left behind in Vrindavan to work with the Gurukul. When Prabhupada returned to Vrindavan later in the year in September, then Shastri was gone. So he somehow or another became dissatisfied in the association of the Western Bhaktas, and he left. But before he left, he had written three nice prayers glorifying Srila Prabhupada. And the Gurukul boys in Vrindavan learnt these prayers. And then in September, when we came back, then when Prabhupada had finished giving his Bhagavatam class and we were just packing up ready for him to return to his quarters, all the Gurukul boys they would stand in front of Srila Prabhupada's Vyasasan, and then they would sing very nicely these three prayers and another prayer that they got from another Shastra. And that was a feature every morning, that they would chant these prayers. So another project, Hayagriva Prabhu. We've already discussed about his editing. But on May 27th, 1976, when we were in Hawaii, on the way back in the car from his morning walk, Prabhupada continued to push the same principle of unity by acceptance of God as the Father, especially since the American people declare, "In God we trust." That's written on all the currency notes, "In God we trust." "That is very nice," Prabhupada said, "but why do you take this philosophy blindly? Find out who God is and why you should trust. That is intelligence. The slogan is nice. Why don't you fight on this issue, the Krishna consciousness movement? You can fight on this issue. Intelligently, if we put, we trust in God, but what is God? Ayagriva?" So they like to trust in God. Then ask them, what is God? And he told Hayagriva to write about it in a special paper. Actually, Prabhupada had written a letter to the President of the United States when we were in Hawaii, because we were going to Washington later on in the tour. So he had written a letter to the American President saying that, you know, this Krishna consciousness movement is actually based on trust in God. So you have "In God We Trust" written on your currency, so why don't you join with us and help us to actually make this a reality so that the American people will become glorious by trusting in God? Of course, we never got a reply, but Prabhupada sent the letter anyway, just in case. So there was another devotee that Prabhupada commented about who had proposed writing a book, a commentary, but without asking Srila Prabhupada. And that was a devotee called Siddhaswarupananda Goswami, who led the first breakaway movement from ISKCON. In 1973, he and a large number of followers suddenly decided to leave ISKCON and go their own way. But Prabhupada had kept some contact with them. They weren't rejecting Srila Prabhupada, but they were rejecting ISKCON and everything to do with ISKCON. Of course, they didn't realize that Prabhupada said, "I am ISKCON." They had their own idea, and this man, he had been like a guru before he became Prabhupada's disciple. So basically speaking, he just wanted to go off and become a guru again. When we were in Melbourne on April the 21st, 1976, I think we were coming back from a morning walk, and there was some discussion about Siddhaswarupananda and his group, because they were based in Hawaii, New Zealand, and Australia, and there was always difficulties dealing with them. Sometimes they would harass the devotees by having articles put in the newspapers criticizing ISKCON. And they were always criticizing the ISKCON devotees for their book distribution. And, generally speaking, they were devotees that were unable to live in the temple atmosphere. They found it too restrictive. So they had rejected deity worship as being for neophytes. That was their thing. That's for the neophytes. The ISKCON devotees are all neophytes, and we're just into chanting. So that was their whole thing. They just liked to chant. The real reason, of course, was that they actually couldn't live up to the standards that was required, you know, the sadhana that was required to stay in a temple. So they went off on their own way. Anyway, there were so many differences of opinion. So the revolutionary instinct is one of the characteristics that has made Srila Prabhupada so successful in his preaching. He tells things as it is. It also separates him from some of his godbrothers. He recalled a recent report that his godbrother Bon Maharaj, who had been the first to come to the West in the 1930s to preach, was telling our devotees not to say controversial things in public. Prabhupada dismissed him in strong terms as a self-interested person who was simply after some following. So, This prompted Guru Kripa Swami to question Prabhupada about Siddhasarupa Nanda Maharaj's group and their motives. They also criticize ISKCON devotees for strong preaching tactics, and they have their own approach, which is designed to avoid generating controversy with the public. Being aware of their activities in the South Sea area, Guru Kripa said that he felt that they were suffering from the same disease as Bon Maharaj. They were not following what Prabhupada was doing, but have created their own way to spread Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada confirmed this. Yes, that idea is there. Although he always encourages them to chant and to maintain the regulative principles, Srila Prabhupada frankly analyzed Siddhasarupa and his followers. They are thinking of their own way. That is bad. We have got so many literatures. They are printing their own literature, and that is disturbing. What will he prepare? He is not a liberated person. He is thinking, somebody said that, oh, I will give my interpretation on the Bhagavat. So if these things are going on, they are against our principles. So the report was that he had written a few of his own books, rather than distribute Prabhupada's books. And the report was that now he's going to do a commentary on the Bhagavatam, as if Prabhupada's commentary wasn't sufficient. And without asking Prabhupada, of course, taking permission from his own guru. So therefore Prabhupada made this comment that he is not a liberated person, so what will he write? That was his comment. So expressing faith in Prabhupada's direction, Guru Kripa Maharaj said, "You know how to spread Krishna consciousness, therefore I follow. I don't even know what Krishna is, I'm just trying to follow. Therefore that will be successful." "That is my preaching," Prabhupada said. "What Krishna said, you say, as it is. Don't change. How you can give interpretation? And if he thinks that he can give another interpretation, what is this nonsense? Then he is not following Guru or Krishna or both. Guru Krishna Kripaya. One has to receive the mercy of Guru and Krishna. Through the Guru, Krishna's mercy." So, that was another example of not writing, or not writing the right thing at least. So, a few comments that Prabhupada made about what not to write about. So, December 19th, 1975, we were in Bombay. And Prabhupada had just taken rest. It was late in the evening. So after I set up the mosquito net over Prabhupada's bed, he laid down. I climbed inside also, sitting cross-legged at his side, gently massaging his hips, legs and feet. Prabhupada talked briefly about Freud. He said that producing such a complicated philosophy and writing volumes of books just to understand sexual attraction, which is there naturally even in the pigs, is like bringing a cannon to kill a mosquito. Big philosophy, he said, is not required for these things. So that's a comment about a non-devotee author. And something again on the same line about Freud. May 1st, 1976, we were in Fiji. So we're having a discussion. Prabhupada was telling us that people are accepting ignorance as knowledge, and he identified a couple of the modern culprits who are the cause of this. He had some very strong words to say about them. Darwin's theory. It is simply speculation on ignorance, and it has been taken as knowledge. And that Freud's philosophy is the business of hogs and dogs, and it has been taken as philosophy. Even the hogs and dogs know how to enjoy sex life. On account of sex life, they have written a philosophy. Is that philosophy? These rascals, they are agyana, dealing with sex life, dealing with the body as their philosophy, science, and they are passing on as philosopher and scientist. This is their position, the whole world. So, how much Krishna consciousness is important? Just imagine. Much to our amusement, he gave a graphic example to illustrate the materialists' real positions. "They are animals," he said. "What will the dog understand? When there is one lady dog, one dozen dogs will come, smelling the best part of the body. This is their philosophy. So Freud is that, the best part of the body. He is writing philosophy. Just see, this is the position. How low taste, hogs and pigs business, and write philosophy. His books are selling like anything. Prabhupada sometimes didn't pull any punches. Telling it as it is. September the 9th, 1976, again on the same topic, writing about sex. This is the obsession of the materialists. But this time Prabhupada was referring to so-called devotees that do this. So we were in Vrindavan. Prabhupada was saying that those who are habituated to illicit sex are punishable. Asat. It is very, very bad. And still, if somebody does like that, he is punished, he was saying. He was talking about people in Vrindavan. This is going on. Here, illicit sex. The Babajis, I have heard them say, oh, what is the wrong there? It is love. So they take it like that. They take it that, oh, it is Gopi's love. They say that. Oh, the Gopis used to do that. They used to have illicit mixing and intermingling with Krishna. So what is the wrong, they'll say. They get support from Krishna Leela. Such rogues they are, these Sahajis. There are so many so-called gentlemen, and they are writing books on Krishna Leela, painting picture. Oh, this is very nice. Krishna is advocating illicit intermingling. So they take it as a support for their sinful activities. I have seen personally, anyone who is a woman hunter, he's being addressed by his friend, oh, you are just like Krishna. So they take Krishna as a man. So how they will take instruction from Krishna? Avajananti mam mudha, panambhava majananta. We are teaching people to become Krishna conscious, to become servant of Krishna. And the so-called enlightened gentlemen, they take Krishna as a debauchee, black debauchee. And they take the Vaishnava religion as sex. So, I actually met a man like that when my daughter was in hospital in Calcutta for a few days. Then there was another girl in the same ward. So then her father came, and then we got talking. He was a nice man, but he told me that I asked him, you know, he was asking us what we do, and I was explaining about Krishna consciousness. And then he said, actually, my favorite book is the Bhagavad Gita. So I thought, oh, that's nice. So then we got talking about it. And then I asked him, well, you know, why don't you become a devotee if you're reading Bhagavad Gita? He said, no, no, no. He said, I like to make up my own meanings for the verses. He said, I like to, you know, to speculate and see what meanings I can make up when I read the verses. So I said, but Krishna says that you should surrender to him. So then he said, no, no, I have no interest in Krishna. He said, why should he enjoy everything? Why not me? He actually said that. So this is their idea, that Krishna is enjoying so many cowherd girls. Why not me? And this man is this is his favorite book, Bhagavad Gita. But what is he understanding from it? Nothing. So that's the problem. So, again, writing about the body, this is not philosophy. Honolulu, May 27th, 1976. Prabhupada again was talking on this point about the scientists. So what is the use of talking foolishly like God is dead, he said. God is never dead. This is going on. This morning we were talking. So we are concerned with the laws of God. God may be dead or alive, it doesn't matter. Suppose by law we are prisoners. We are in the prison house, and all of a sudden the president or the king dies. Does it mean that now you shall be free? No. You remember that the government is prakriti, material nature. Prabhupada declared that anyone who proclaims such a philosophy is actually dead, because he identifies with the gross physical body, which is always dead. It is simply a machine and moves only due to the presence of the soul. As Krishna chastised Arjuna in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita for his bodily concerns, Srila Prabhupada similarly criticized the modern day thinkers. So, all these rascal philosophers, they are writing about this body, that's all. But this is not the subject for the learned scholars. What is this body? a combination of matter. It is moving, and as soon as the living soul is out of the body, it is useless. So, what is there important talking about this dead body? His conclusion was as crushingly final to the foolish philosopher's speculative talk as death itself. When death will come, no one will save you. You are challenging God is dead. When God will come and make you killed, nobody can save you. We are so foolish for thinking that God is dead, and I shall continue with my life and my wife and my children and my countrymen, and my nation will save me. That is not possible. So actually, it's interesting. I did a bit of research once, and I saw that when Srila Prabhupada began his preaching in America in 1966, there was an article, famous article, probably you all know about, that came in the Village Other. It was a local newspaper in downtown New York. And it showed a picture of Srila Prabhupada standing underneath a tree, and he was preaching. And the article was about how Prabhupada had come to tell us that God is not dead. So that was the whole feature of the Aishushri Gwanatai. That was the whole feature of it, that we've been told that God is dead, but now the Swamiji's come to tell us that God is not dead. So Prabhupada was very pleased with that, because actually, about a month or 2 months previously, there had been a Time magazine, and on the front cover of the Time magazine in 1966, just when Prabhupada had got ISKCON going, there was a big headline, God is dead. And the whole article was about how philosophers have rejected the idea of God. So a couple of months later, then this newspaper article came out with Prabhupada on the front cover saying God is not dead. So Prabhupada used to refer to that quite often, that God is dead. This is their idea. But the only person that will be dead is the person that's saying that God is dead. God is not dead and never will be. So, now, sometimes it may be that even the guru does not write things which is the absolute truth. Sometimes he writes something which is not true under certain circumstances. And there was one class that Prabhupada gave in Vrindavan on April the 7th, 1976, where he mentioned this. So he said that he gave us some good examples to establish that only a genuine devotee is actually a perfect gentleman. Others are not. He was speaking about the word Bhadra. Bhadra means gentleman. So he said, being a gentleman is only possible if one is a devotee. He said, a devotee is a perfect gentleman. Why? Now, because he has developed all good qualities. That is Bhadra. A devotee cannot be Abhadra. Therefore, a devotee is never rude to anyone. When Rupa Goswami was here, some very learned scholar came to talk with him on Shastra. So when he approached Rupa Goswami, he said, I want to talk with you about Shastra. So Rupa Goswami, he said, oh, I'm not a very learned man. How can I talk with you? You are so learned. So the man said, if you think that you are not learned, then you give me in writing that I am not learned. So immediately Rupa Goswami gave him, all right, you take it, I am not learned. So Prabhupada left. So when he was going away, that cheat, he was thinking, oh, I am the most learned scholar, and Rupa Goswami is defeated. Then Jiva Goswami, he was standing outside. So he asked, what is that paper? No, your uncle has written frankly that he is not learned. I am learned. All right, now you talk with me. Then Jiva Goswami defeated him. So sometimes the devotees are so gentle. If a foolish person comes to talk, unnecessarily, waste of time, all right, you take in writing that I am not learned. Go away. You see? So this is Bhadra. Instead of wasting time with a rascal, better to give him a paper. Go away, sir. So sometimes what the guru writes is not the absolute truth. And actually we have that practical experience sometimes when you go out in Sankirtan, at least in the West. I don't know about in Croatia, but one of the first things that you have to learn how to deal with when you first start selling books, is how to deal with the born-again Christians. Yeah? They come and they harass you and they want to harangue you and discuss. So the better thing is to be very humble and say, no, you're right. That's all right. Go away. And go on with your business of selling Prabhupada's books. Otherwise, if you get caught up in a discussion with them, they'll never hear what you have to say. They only have their own dogma, and that's all they're interested in. So don't waste time. This is the example, Rupa Goswami. Don't waste time with fools and rascals. So another thing on Prabhupada's writing. This is the last item actually on this. Let's see. When we went to Los Angeles, June the 5th, 1976, then Prabhupada took a tour of the FATE exhibition. FATE is the first American theistic exhibition, and it was the first attempt by the devotees to create a diorama display. Srila Prabhupada was very keen on the diorama displays, because in the 1930s, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he had some massive diorama displays of Krishna Leela and Chaitanya Leela, which they were displaying in, I think in Calcutta they had it, then they took it to Dhaka, and many thousands of people were coming every day to see these dioramas. And it was a very powerful and effective way of showing Krishna consciousness, philosophy, to people, you know, that may not normally want to read a book or hear the philosophy, but they would come and see these moving dioramas. So in the early 70s, as soon as Prabhupada got set up in Mayapur, then he asked if there were any artists amongst his disciples, then they could come to Mayapur and they could learn how to make the dioramas. You'll see in West Bengal especially, there are many, many artisans, and they make all the time. They're always making these clay dioramas for various pujas, Durga, especially Durga, but Saraswati Puja, etc. So Prabhupada had our devotees go there and learn the art of making these dolls, these dioramas. Then later on, then they went back to Los Angeles. Then they began adapting Western methods along with the Eastern traditions that they learnt about doll making. So they were making these life-size dioramas, and they actually made a whole exhibit on based on the Bhagavad Gita, illustrating different points of philosophy and the universal form, Krishna Leela, etc. So when Prabhupada visited in 76, they were about halfway through that attempt. Later on, I think it opened in 77, and it's still there. I was just in Los Angeles last month, and we had a look around that exhibit. It's still very wonderful, very beautiful dolls. So one exhibit in particular is truly wonderful, that of Srila Prabhupada himself sitting at his writing desk in his Radha Damodar room in Vrindavan. Made by Lochan Das, the exhibit will be designed so that the head of the diorama slowly looks up as the rays of the rising sun fill the room. Srila Prabhupada had not been informed that his figure actually moved. As he approached it, the devotees switched on the mechanism, causing the head to look up just as Srila Prabhupada reached it. So Prabhupada's looking at himself, and his Murti looks up at him. His reaction was a delightful mix of humility, appreciation, and wonder. So realistic is the figure that it was like gazing at two Srila Prabhupadas simultaneously. So, actually, that's the end of this seminar, the book writing seminar. The only other thing that I can add is that the other feature of Prabhupada's writing was that he was very prolific correspondence. There's over 6,000 letters that Srila Prabhupada wrote in the course of about 9 or 10 years preaching work. A few from before that. But we see actually Prabhupada was always engaged in writing. It wasn't just writing books, not just back to Godhead, but he was also very active in writing letters to often very important people. There are quite a few letters that we still have record of him writing to, you know, the Prime Minister of India, the President of India. He wrote to Mahatma Gandhi. He wrote to Indira Gandhi. He wrote to Prime Minister Shastri, etc., etc. Prabhupada was always very active in propagating Krishna consciousness through the medium of writing. And when ISKCON began to blossom, then Prabhupada would spend hours and hours sometimes writing letters to his disciples. If you look in the early days, 66, 67, 68, the letters that Prabhupada was writing were very long. And Prabhupada would very elaborately explain to devotees different philosophical points or, you know, practices of Krishna consciousness. And he was doing at that time the typing all himself. But then as things expanded, then he got a secretary and he also got a servant to personally assist him. And from that time on, then he used to write by dictating rather than sitting down at the typewriter himself. Of course, there were no computers in those days. It was all manual typewriters. So Prabhupada would hear the letters that were sent to him very often about maybe between 10 and 11 in the morning after he'd had his morning rest after breakfast and before his massage. Or if he was meeting people during that period, then he would wait until the massage, and then as he was receiving his massage, then the secretary would come with whatever letters had arrived during that day, and then he would read them out to Srila Prabhupada. So Prabhupada would hear the letters, and then he would reply to them as if the person that had sent it was sitting there in front of him. So he would speak like that and give his reply. And then the secretary, he would write down notes on the sheet or a notepad, whatever. Then he would go off and he would type up what Prabhupada had dictated. And then in the evening time, then the letter that had been sent to Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada's reply with a carbon copy and the envelope with the correct address on it to send it to, that would all be clipped together, and then that would be put onto Prabhupada's desk in the night time by the secretary. Then when Prabhupada got up to do his translation work in the night time, then he would read those letters, his replies, and then he would sign them. And then in the morning the secretary would come and he would take them away and then he would immediately post them. So Prabhupada was very attentive about his mail. He would always reply a letter within 1 or 2 days at the most. So regular correspondence was always coming in, and usually maybe about 4 or 5 letters every day were coming in on average. So Prabhupada was a very attentive letter writer. Later on, when he got sick in 1977, from about April onwards, then he was not actually even doing that. What happened was that then the secretary, who was Tamal Krishna Maharaj at that time, he would come and he would read the letters to Srila Prabhupada, or he would give a summary of the letter, and then Prabhupada would make a few comments, but then he left it to Tamal Krishna Maharaj to write the letter and to send it out without him even seeing it. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj would sign it on behalf of Srila Prabhupada. So the last little bit of correspondence that you see of Srila Prabhupada, that's why you'll see there are no letters from Prabhupada practically from April 77 up until the time of his disappearance, because he was having Tamal Krishna Maharaj reply all the mail rather than do it himself. So he's kind of handing things over there. So that's it as far as Prabhupada's book writing goes. Do we have any questions or comments at this point? Anybody curious about anything about Srila Prabhupada? No, but yeah. Prabhupada was pacifying Samati Mararaji. He was apologizing for his editors that they don't know the principle of Satyam Bruyat Priyam Bruyat. There were occasions when Prabhupada wouldn't say things you know, too heavily, depending on the audience that he was speaking to. Like there was a Mayavadi sannyasi that came to see Prabhupada in London in 76. Sachamritananda his name was. So Prabhupada knew he's going to come and he's going to speak all nonsense, which he did. He came and he started asking Prabhupada about, you know, why we don't worship Durga and Shiva and this one and that one, and after all, aren't they all the same? And Prabhupada told him that, you know, very frankly, that no, we don't agree with you. So he said, I do not wish to discuss on these points, because if I say something, you'll become angry. So Prabhupada said, better not to talk about it. So he just diverted the conversation and kept it very light. But he wouldn't discuss philosophy with this man, because Prabhupada knew that if he did, then Prabhupada was going to get really angry with him. Because when Prabhupada talked with Mayavadis, very often he couldn't contain his anger. As soon as they started saying that Krishna was, you know, the same as Shiva or Durga or this or that, he would become like fire. So he didn't, you know, he didn't like to get into too many conversations with the Mayavadis. So that's an example of, you know, priyam bruyat, speaking nicely, just keeping friends, but not getting into anything serious. But it's also a fact that sometimes Prabhupada did speak, you know, very heavy stuff. And there was an example of that when we went to Madras on the 1st of January in 1976. Tamal Krishna Maharaj had just flown in that morning, actually, from America to be the secretary for that month. And then immediately we flew down to Madras. And the devotees had arranged two pandal programs on the first and second evening in what was a very big marriage hall in Madras there. So there were about 2,000 people attending. It was very, you know, completely packed up. And Prabhupada spoke. And, you know, he told people very frankly that everybody's living like cats and dogs. You know, this is not human life unless you take up Krishna consciousness. Like that. So he was speaking quite strongly. So later on when we got back to the place that we were staying, Prabhupada asked me, he said, bring the tape recording of the lecture. So then we sat down and we replayed the tape for Prabhupada to hear. He was listening to his own lecture. So what these children should be given something to occupy themselves. They shouldn't disturb like this. So when Prabhupada heard the part where he was saying, you know, that people are living like cats and dogs, then he started laughing. And he said, oh, he said, I have spoken so strongly. And he said, and still they heard. Nobody objected. Yes, we are cats and dogs. So the thing is that Prabhupada could sometimes speak very strongly like that, and he could tell people, you know, you're cats and dogs. And they would listen and hear it, because Prabhupada was able to deliver the philosophy without any false ego. You know, it's not like he was trying to impress them with his knowledge, you know, or he was trying to... Sometimes when people get into debates, they're trying to defeat each other. And that comes over, they have this ego. So then the other one, he doesn't like the first one's ego. So they argue like this, and each one's trying to put one over the other. And it doesn't matter what the point is that they're making, one has to try to conquer the other. But when Prabhupada spoke, it wasn't like that. He was completely free of any false ego. He was simply there to help people. He was trying to give people information how to improve their lives. And so sometimes he had to tell them very frankly, you know, the condition, present condition of their lives, which was not very auspicious. So that required sometimes some strong speaking. But he could speak strongly and people would hear it because he had no false ego. They, you know, when people heard Prabhupada, they appreciated that he's actually speaking for my benefit. So if you're expert, you can speak like that. And therefore he told the editors of Back to Godhead that, you know, you're not expert. Or he was telling Samati Mararaji that these boys that are the editors, they're not very expert because they don't know Sacham Bruyat, Priyam Bruyat. They don't know how to speak nicely. or in such a way that people can hear nicely. So it was a dual purpose. But Prabhupada, yeah, sometimes he spoke really strongly. And sometimes he didn't mind if it was extremely controversial and that people became angry with him. You know, he would stick to his point sometimes. Like in 1975, when he went to America, then, you know, he made a comment that women are not as intelligent as men. So when this was publicized, then one of the TV channels in Chicago, they sent a camera team, an interviewer, and camera team, all women. And they came and they said, "Did you say, you know, women are not as intelligent as men?" And Prabhupada said, "Well, don't mind, but yes." And it was on the TV, you know, and they advertised that this Swamiji is, you know, he thinks that women are less than men or whatever. So they tried to make a big thing of it, but Prabhupada just held his line. He wasn't disturbed. He wasn't going to change his, you know, his philosophy just to suit, you know, the political correctness and the political sentiments, you know, of a few people. He was speaking from Shastra, that's it. So he didn't care. So sometimes, you know, when you speak, and same like with the moon landing, Prabhupada insisted they never went to the moon. And he never changed that, even if he said it in public. He wasn't embarrassed, you know, to say something from Shastra. And he wasn't perturbed if some people couldn't accept it either. Because he knew that, you know, there's always going to be some people that can't accept what is the truth. What can you do? So it's a mixture. Satyam bruyat, priyam bruyat. Sometimes you tell the truth. Sometimes you have to say something that's pleasing. Depending on the circumstances and depending on who you're talking to. Alright? Somebody else had a question? Yes, Guru. That's a fairly complex question. I'll give an overview of Prabhupada's daily activities. In one sense, Prabhupada's day and didn't begin or end. It's like Krishna's leelas, you know, they just flow on and on and on. Even if Krishna disappears from our sight here, his leelas going on somewhere else. And Prabhupada's activities were a little bit like that, actually. Because, you know, for us, we have a day, and then we go to sleep, and that's the end of the day. And then when we wake up, that's a new day. But Prabhupada didn't do that. So I'll try and explain, you know, I'll give a brief overview of his typical day, if you like. Because he was translating during the night. So we'll begin at Mangalarti time. So when all the devotees were getting up for Mangalarti, that was when Prabhupada would stop writing. And then usually he would go, either he would chant a little japa, or he would just kind of relax a little bit in his room. Very often he would send for the local GBC or sannyasis or temple managers and chat with them for a while. Or, you know, he would just kind of snooze a little bit and just have a little rest. But then at 6 o'clock or around that time, he would go and he would freshen up, brush his teeth, wash his face, do his ablutions, and then come back in the room, put his tilak on, chant his morning gayatri, and then by that time it would be ready for his morning walk. So just at the appearance of dawn, then Prabhupada would go out and he would go on his walk. Depending on where we were, sometimes he would drive there, or sometimes he would just walk out the door, as we used to in Vrindavan. So he would generally walk for about an hour, and very often, you know, he would be discussing philosophy. He would be challenging the devotees sometimes, you know, provoking discussion on different philosophical points so that he could train us up how to answer, you know, difficult questions. So morning walks were very nice, actually. Usually they were quite lively. But sometimes he would just walk and not say anything. and just walk for half an hour and then come back. So then he would generally arrive back at the temple just in time for greeting of the deities. So he'd greet the deities, take Charanamrita, then he'd go to the Vyasasan, then he would receive his Guru Puja, and then after that, then he would give his Bhagavatam class. And Prabhupada never missed the Bhagavatam class unless he was seriously ill. Every day, wherever we were, he would immediately drop into the same schedule. So he'd give his Bhagavatam class. Except I can remember when we got into Melbourne, instead of speaking in the morning and giving class in the morning, he was giving class in the evening, because the devotees had arranged, you know, to have like a festival every evening whilst Prabhupada was there, and they'd advertised. So then Prabhupada was speaking in the night time rather than in the morning. But generally, always he would give the Bhagavatam class. Then after Bhagavatam class, then he would go back to his quarters. Whilst he was speaking, there was usually the cook or some of the local temple devotees. They would prepare his breakfast, and then that would be ready for him as soon as he got back into his quarters. Breakfast was generally different kinds of cut fruit. Sometimes he would have muri, that's like puffed rice. Generally he would have fried cashew nuts, just a few, lightly browned, fried in ghee. And sometimes he would have, you know, maybe like a little fried something or other. There was one preparation that I actually learnt to make. Although I wasn't the cook, I think I was the only servant of Prabhupada's that couldn't cook. So I always had to get somebody else to do it. But there were a couple of things that I did learn that Prabhupada liked. And these things he used to take sometimes for breakfast. One of them was Urdal paste. You just soak it overnight and then paste it up in the morning, and then just drops of it, mix it with salt, pepper, red chili powder and fresh green chilies chopped up, and then put little balls of that, drop it in hot ghee. It's called wada or butter, there's different names, but like in India you get this dahi wada. So I'd make the wada but without the dahi. And then Prabhupada would eat that. He liked that. Just small little balls. And there was another preparation that I used to make for him sometimes, which was flat rice, not puffed rice. Sometimes they call it rolled rice. It's just rice that's been flattened out. So I'd deep fry that. Then I'd deep fry small potato cubes. Then I'd deep fry peas. And then mix it all together. And then throw in red chili powder, black pepper, salt and fresh green chilies chopped up, and Prabhupada liked that also. So that was a couple of things that I used to make sometimes for breakfast for him. So then after, and then also he would sometimes take like a half a sandesh or something like that. So then after breakfast, then he would usually sit for maybe 15 or 20 minutes just to let the digestive process get going. Or one item that he took at breakfast before he ate anything else was fresh sliced ginger root, and soaked in lemon juice. So he'd have a couple of pieces of that just to get the fire of digestion going. So then he would sit for 20 minutes. Sometimes he would just chant a couple of rounds. Sometimes he would sit and talk with us for a few minutes. And then he would go and he would take rest for about 1 hour. So then that was usually like from about 9 until 10 o'clock. And that was a regular thing. Then, from 10 till about 11:30, he would generally meet with visitors. Anybody that had asked to see him, they could get an appointment with the secretary, and they were usually booked in, you know, in that morning session. If there was nobody there to see him, then Prabhupada would often do his mail instead. Then at 11:30, then I would come with Prabhupada's gumsha, a bottle of sandalwood oil and a bottle of mustard oil, and then I give Prabhupada his massage. Generally he liked to have his massage in the sunshine if it wasn't too hot. If it was too hot, then he would take it inside. But if it was, especially like in the winter time in India, it was very nice to sit outside because it was always sunny and the rays of the sun were not too scorching. So just like in Vrindavan, we would go out into the back garden and Prabhupada would sit on a straw mat, and then I'd give him his massage. So we'd use the sandalwood oil on his head, and then the mustard oil on the rest of his body. So that massage took an hour and a half. And Prabhupada liked a really strong massage. You know, as hard as you could do it, that he liked it that much. So after his massage, then he would go into the bathroom and he would bathe. So generally he would bathe with warm water. Prabhupada used to bathe out of buckets. Because he grew up in rural India. Or not rural, actually Calcutta, but he grew up, you know, bathing out of buckets, and that became his habit. And practically his whole life, as far as I know, Prabhupada never ever bathed in anything except cold water. And even when he was living in Allahabad, which is in northern India, and it gets very cold there during the winter time, we were told that Prabhupada still was only bathing in cold water. That was his habit. But after he had this huge heart attack in 1967, and he had been hospitalized, then at that point, then he was told by the doctor now that, you know, you should use warm water because cold water is too much of a shock for your system and it's very dangerous for you. So only because the doctor told him, then he began to bathe in warm water. And what we used to do was heat up one bucket with hot water if it wasn't on tap. In India, in those days, you couldn't get hot water on tap. So we used to get these, you know, electric things that you stick in the bucket and then switch it on halfway through the massage. And then by the end of the massage, then the water was hot. Then Prabhupada would fill up the other bucket half with cold water. Then he'd pour the hot water in just to get it to the right temperature. And then he would bathe. So he would always bathe with his gamsha on. And generally he would bathe sitting on like a low table. So he would have a bucket and a lota, and he would bathe away and wash off the oil, soap up, and like that. So whilst Prabhupada was bathing, then the servant would go into his bedroom. We'd take out a clean set of cloth, and we'd transfer. He had these gold buttons that you could pull out, you know, from his kurta. You'd take the buttons out the dirty kurta and put them in the clean one, lay out his kaupin and his lungi and his kurta, and then go into his sitting room. And Prabhupada would come out and he would change into fresh clothing. And then in the sitting room, he would come and sit down, and he had a little tiny lota about this big, about an inch and a half high, like 2 centimeters. Nice little silver one with a lid on it and a tiny little spoon. So we used to scoop out a couple of spoonfuls of water and leave that on the lid. And then when Prabhupada came in, he would put that in the palm of his hand. And then there was a little ball of tilak. And he would mix up his tilak in his hand, put on fresh tilak, and then he would chant his Gayatri mantra. So on two occasions, actually, I was very fortunate that Prabhupada, when he put on his tilak, he had some extra in the palm of his hand. So he scraped it up with his finger, and then he wiped it on the edge of his hand. And then he held his hand out and he told me to come and take the tilak off his hand. So I did that, scratched it off and put it on. It was very nice. And sometimes he would let you sit in his room whilst he was chanting his Gayatri mantra, and you could chant your Gayatri as well. And Prabhupada used to take about 5 minutes to chant his Gayatri mantra. And very often you could see him moving his lips as he was chanting. But you couldn't hear anything, but he would chant silently, but you could see him move his lips. So then, at 1:30, then we would serve him his lunch. And before I joined the party, the lunch time would vary according to the massage and how long that had taken. And the cooks would try to have his lunch ready for whatever time that, you know, he'd finished bathing and dressing. So that would vary maybe between, you know, half an hour. But later on, when I joined the party, that was so. Harikesh was the cook. But later when we went to Mayapur, Prabhupada adjusted his schedule a little bit and he started having his massage at about 10 o'clock in the morning. And the reason for that was the sun was shining in on the balcony outside his room. But by 11:30, when he normally took his massage, then it had receded or it had gone overhead and there was no more sunshine. So he could sit in the sunshine. He was having his massage earlier at 10 o'clock. But then that was too early for him to have his lunch after the massage. So we regulated. I asked Srila Prabhupada, can we serve you lunch at 1:30 every day? So Prabhupada agreed to that, and we kept to that schedule for the rest of the time that I was with him, at least. So at 1:30, then he knew, now prasadam, is due. So he would sit there in prasadam room. In Vrindavan, he had a separate room for taking prasadam. Otherwise, in most places, we'd have a small table, and Prabhupada would sit down at the table, and then we would serve him out. So lunch, he would have rice, dal, two dry subjis, two wet subjis, maybe a sweet, and hot chapatis. And generally speaking, we'd serve one chapati to begin with, and then if Prabhupada wanted another one, he would have a bell on his little desk. He'd ring the bell, and then the cook would know, okay, another chapati. So we'd throw blow up another chapati, and then we'd run in and drop that on Prabhupada's plate. So generally we would have about three chapatis, unless he was, kind of really enthusiastic. He might have more, but it was generally three chapatis. So if the cooks were expert, then they would make more, but that was the minimum standard. Two dry, two wet subjis, rice dal and chapatis and a sweet. And then if Prabhupada, sometimes he would ask for something extra, or if he was not feeling very well sometimes, then he would just take khichdi. There were a few times when I was with him when he had some problem with dysentery or bad digestion, and so he was just taking khichdi just to, be a little kind to his stomach and bowels. And sometimes, or very often, he would call the cook in and he would discuss with them about the spices that they should use for cooking with. Because in India, of course, spicing is a whole science. Spices are not meant for pleasing the tongue. They're actually meant for, it's an Ayurvedic thing. It's meant for balancing the doshas in the body by eating. So when you eat, you like to eat something, but it's not necessarily always that good for you. So by using the correct spicing, you can actually keep your body very fit and healthy. So Prabhupada used to very often call in the cook and discuss with them what spices to use, for that particular day, according to how he was feeling. So lunch then 1:30 to about 2 o'clock. Then again, Prabhupada would sit for 15-20 minutes, let that digest. Then he would take another second rest of the day, 1 hour. So maybe from about 2:30 to 3:30, like that. Then when he rose, after his afternoon rest, then he would sit down in his darshan room and we would have ready for him a fresh flower garland, sandalwood paste. We put sandalwood on his forehead, and we would also give him either a cup of fresh fruit juice or, if we could get it, coconut water, dub. He liked that very much. And then from maybe about 4 o'clock until 6 o'clock, generally he would have an open darshan. So anybody that was there that wanted to come and see him, they could come and sit in his room. Especially in India, of course, that was very popular. People would come and they would sit and they would look at him. And Prabhupada would sit there and chant japa. And then after some time, they would be happy that they'd seen the sadhu, and then they would go. Sometimes people would come and they would ask questions, and then Prabhupada would discuss with them. So like that, from, 4 until about 6 or 6:30. Then when the conch shell sounded for the aarti, evening aarti, then Prabhupada would send everybody out and tell them to go to the aarti. Then in the evening time, again, generally he would speak with his managers and discuss, different problems that may have arisen or things that he'd noticed that he wanted doing, etc. Then about 9 o'clock, then everybody was sent out except the personal servants. And about 9:30, then he would take a glass of hot milk. And that was practically every single night Prabhupada would have hot milk. The only time that I saw that he didn't do that was when we were in Mayapur in 76, and he was having some problem with his digestion. So instead of having a glass of hot milk, he was having a half a rasgulla. So he was saying, now I'm taking my milk in solid form. So half a rasgulla. And that would give him some strength for the evening, for the coming, you know, period of translation work. Sometimes he did eat at night. He would call in the cook and he would ask, you know, for some kind of savory. Very often it was like aloo paratha or kachuri, something like that. And he would have maybe one or half a one or something. And then that would be sufficient. That would give him some strength, you know, to go through the rest of the night. So then about 10 o'clock, usually, he would take rest. And everybody else, of course, would go and take rest except the servant. Then we would go in and give Prabhupada his second massage of the day. So the second massage, that was a dry massage. Prabhupada would lie down on his bed. If the bed was big enough, then the servant could get up on the bed with him and sit next to him and then massage up and down his legs. And that massage was just from the waist downwards, because, you know, Prabhupada spent most of his day sitting. You know, he would have his morning walk, and that was practically the only exercise that he got for the whole day. And he would spend the rest of the time sitting. He explained one time to a visitor in Melbourne that he said, he was telling his schedule, and he said, and in the morning I go for this 1 hour's walk. He said, otherwise, just simply sitting all day, then the joints become jammed up. So in the evening, that massage was to help with circulation and just, you know, keep his muscles supple and his joints working. So that could vary from, you know, 15 minutes to anything up to 2 hours, depending where we were. On average, I think probably about half an hour, 45 minutes for the evening massage. And that evening massage, which I thought when I first joined the party, I thought was really easy. Because the first evening when I'd been at, you know, asked to come in and be taught by Upendra how to massage Prabhupada, I'd gone in at 9 o'clock, and then about 9:30 at night Prabhupada had gone to take rest. This was in the temple in Bengali markets in New Delhi. So Prabhupada went in, he laid down, the lights went off, and then Upendra stood at the side and he began to massage. And he told me, he said, actually, when you're massaging Prabhupada at night, you have to keep massaging until he tells you that you can go. He said, when I first did this, he said, I was massaging and Prabhupada fell asleep. So I thought, oh, Prabhupada's asleep, I can stop now. So I was just walking out, and I just got to the door, and then Prabhupada's voice came out of the darkness, oh, you were finished? So then he had to go back and keep on going. So he said, you can't stop until Prabhupada tells you. And it wasn't that Prabhupada would say, okay, now you can stop. Very often he would just say, And that was it. And then you'd know, now you can go. And if you didn't hear that, then you had to keep on going. So sometimes Prabhupada would fall asleep, and you had to keep on going. And when I got to, well, anyway, that first night, it was 10 minutes. And then Prabhupada said, and then we went. So I thought, well, that's really easy, no problem. Yeah. And the first few days that I was brought on the party, it was just only to do the massage, nothing else. I wasn't given, you know, like full-time servants' duties. It's just that they wanted somebody to fill in to do Prabhupada's massages. So anyway, later on when I was added to the party as a full-time servant, then, you know, it gradually crept up to about half an hour on average, or 45 minutes. But when we got to Mayapur in 76, then it started getting longer and longer and longer. And in Mayapur, Prabhupada had his bedroom and his sitting room. He had quite a large bed, and we would put a mosquito net over the top of the bed like a big tent, actually, and it would go over the bed. And in the evenings, this fellow, Anantaram Shastri, at dusk, he would come in, and he would have this big clay bowl with frankincense burning in it, and, you know, lots of smoke billowing out, and he had a palm leaf fan, and he had a conch shell. So at dusk, you know, because that's the time when all the subtle creatures start becoming active, so there's some puja that you can do to keep away all the ghosts. So he used to come around every evening on the lotus building. He'd go around all the floors, and he would be blowing this conch shell. And he had this ability where he could suck in air through his nose and blow it out through his mouth at the same time. So he would keep the conch blowing like 5, 10, 15 minutes at a time without stopping. So actually, people that play saxophone, they do the same thing. Yeah, it's some art that you can learn. You're breathing in and blowing out at the same time. It's a bit like being a yogi, you know. You merge the incoming air with the outgoing air. And so anyway, he would blow the conch, and then he would chant these mantras to keep the ghosts out, and then he would fan the frankincense and walk into the room. So he would come into Prabhupada's room, and the whole place would be filled with smoke, so dense that you couldn't see anything. And that was, you know, to help drive away the mosquitoes as well. So, you know, because most of it would have dissipated by the late evening, but still, you can imagine it was quite kind of clammy and muggy inside the room. Then we put this mosquito net up, and we would burn these mosquito coils. And these things, they, you know, give off this really thick, heavy smoke. So we'd have this coil burning. Then Prabhupada would go in and we'd take rest on the bed, and then you'd go underneath the mosquito net with him and sit there next to him, and then all the lights would be off. You know, there's all this thick, heavy incense and, you know, smoke everywhere. There's no breeze, and everybody's asleep, including Srila Prabhupada. And you're the only one that's awake, so you're there, you know, with just your mind for company. And you know, you have to keep on massaging until Prabhupada wakes up and tells you that you can go. So in Mayapur, it was like 1 hour, then an hour and a half, and then a few nights, it was 2 hours. So you can imagine, you've been up all day from 4 o'clock in the morning, and then at night time, everybody's asleep, including Prabhupada, and you're still going up until midnight, sometimes it was, before I could get out of Prabhupada's rooms. So, naturally enough, you know, sometimes you'd get the nods. You know, you start kind of being sleepy a little bit. Start nodding out like this. And then sometimes you'd just go out. And then all of a sudden you'd, you know, wake up again. And you wouldn't know whether you'd been out for 5 seconds or 5 minutes or 15 minutes. But you still keep on going. So that was a very tough service, actually. It was very difficult. So anyway, then when we stopped giving Prabhupada his massage, then we could go and take rest. And then Prabhupada would either take, you know, a little more rest, maybe half an hour or so. Then he would get up, and then he would go into his sitting room, and then he would begin his work. If he had any balance of his rounds to do, then he would chant those first. Then he would start doing his Bhagavatam work, and he would spend then, you know, from maybe midnight through till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, up until Mangalati, doing his translation work and making his commentaries. So that was Prabhupada's regular schedule. And he had that schedule more or less the whole time, at least, you know, that I was with him. And he was incredibly regulated. When we were traveling, of course, when you start traveling around the world, then, you know, there's jet lag and, you know, just the different time zones, it throws your whole system out of whack, you know, so your digestive system and everything, you know, you're in one place, but your stomach's in the other place, you know. So it's difficult. And I used to feel it. I was only 25 at that time, and I was very, you know, pretty fit, you know, and quite strong. But when we were traveling like that, it was tough. But I saw Srila Prabhupada, as soon as he would come into another place, immediately straight into this schedule, without missing a beat, and no extra rest, nothing. It goes straight into the schedule, and it would be just like, you know, normal. The only time that he made any adjustments generally was if we were traveling and we were to, you know, we were scheduled to be flying when he was due to take his massage. Then at that time, then we would give him his massage early in the morning. There were a couple of times when I had to massage him at 4 o'clock in the morning because we were leaving at, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock to get an aeroplane or a train. But other than that, then, you know, he was dead regulated. So Prabhupada, you know, he had this incredible sense control. You know, his mind and his senses were perfectly controlled without effort because he was transcendental. So he wasn't perturbed, you know, by the workings of his body. He could control his situation so that he, you know, he was able to do the work that he wanted to do without any interruption. The only time that he was really interrupted was when his body got really seriously ill and was giving him a lot of problems. Like when we were in Toronto, he got toothache so bad that the side of his face was swollen up. So what he did for that, he took extra rest in the morning, maybe, you know, like 2 hours instead of one, or I think even one morning he slept for 3 hours. And that was when his face was really swollen up. But he wouldn't go to the dentist, nor would he allow us to call a dentist, because he said, if I call a dentist, then he'll just want to take all of them out, all my teeth. So he said, I let them fall out one by one. He said, that's my philosophy. And that's actually what happened, because when that was in June, what he did was actually, the only thing that he did for his toothache was that he, you know, this spice, cloves, yeah? So the clove has a kind of antiseptic, like an anesthetic effect. So he was just sucking some cloves, that's all he was doing for this tooth. And still he was meeting people, he was giving his classes, his face was swollen with this toothache. I mean, any ordinary person, they would have immediately gone, you know, to the dentist, but Prabhupada didn't want to do that. So anyway, a couple of months later, when we arrived back in Bombay on August the 13th, you know, we got settled in, we were going to be there for a couple of days, and then we were going down to Hyderabad on the 17th to open the temple there. So on the 15th morning, I came into Prabhupada's room about 5 o'clock in the morning, and he just finished doing his translation work. So when I walked in, I offered my obeisances and looked up, and Prabhupada sat back and he smiled. So when he smiled, there was a gap in his mouth that wasn't there the night before. So I was shocked, you know, Prabhupada's lost a tooth. So I said, Prabhupada, what happened to your tooth? So he didn't say anything, he just reached down, there was a drawer in the desk, he pulled the drawer open and the tooth's lying in the drawer. So, somehow or another in the night, either the tooth had fallen out, or he just pulled it out because it was giving him trouble. He put it in the drawer, and went on with his work. You know, Prabhupada was completely transcendental, you know, to his body. And anyway, as it happened, I was able to get that tooth. I still have it. It's upstairs right now. So, that's another story. But, anyway, I mean, that was Prabhupada's situation. He, you know, he had this incredible tolerance. There was another time when we were in Delhi, and this was at the end of March. We were staying at the house of Lakshman Agarwal. He was the owner of Sylvania Lakshman Light Bulb Company. They were a big company in those days. And he had a house in Chanakapuri, which is like the really rich area of New Delhi. It's where all the diplomats stay and all the really rich people. So we were staying there, we did a little pandal outside his house, and there was also a big pandal that they had on the main Mela grounds in Delhi, I think near Red Fort. So one evening, Prabhupada had been giving a darshan. Then everybody went out, and the seat that Prabhupada was sitting on, it was like it had a low wooden frame, maybe, you know, about 10 centimeters high off the ground. And then there was, you know, some cotton on the top, cotton mattress. So Prabhupada stood up to go to the bathroom, and he stood up on the asana, and then he stepped down just, you know, a few inches onto the ground. Now, on the ground, there was a carpet. So as soon as his heel hit the carpet flew out from underneath him, and Prabhupada came crashing down and landed on his hip on the side, on the wooden edge of this asana. I mean, right down on top of it. It really whacked it. And then he, you know, bounced down onto the ground. And, you know, I was sitting in front of him, but it happened so fast, there was no chance of doing anything to help him. He just, within a half a second, he was down on the ground, you know, sitting with, you know, his hip had bounced off the edge of this wooden board. And not a sound came from his lips. I mean, anybody, when you get even a bite or a, you know, prick or, you know, you fall or something, you say something, you know, it's automatic. You exclaim, you know, ah, or whatever. Not a single sound. Prabhupada just, it, you know, it kind of stunned him momentarily, but not a sound came from his lips. I helped him to his feet. He just rubbed his hip, and then he just went to the bathroom and carried on like nothing had happened. So he had this, you know, amazing tolerance, sense control. And because of that, he was able to regulate his activities very, very strictly, despite the tremendous pressures that were on him and demands, you know, for his time and for his energy. Prabhupada was the only person I've met that was able to write and manage at the same time. It's really, really difficult. I know Tamal Krishna Maharaj, for some time, he was also doing that. He was managing, and he was able to write some books as well. But even he couldn't sustain that for very long. And if you knew Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he was a very, very determined person. And he also, you know, he was very strictly self-controlled. But Srila Prabhupada was doing this for years. You know, for 10 years practically. That was his schedule. It was only when he got really, really sick in 1977 that schedule changed. And from March 77 onwards, then the whole, you know, feature of Prabhupada's preaching was changed. Actually, in February, I had been thinking about actually leaving the party, because I'd been with him about 16 months at that time, and I was starting to feel a little stale. You know, things were becoming a little too routine. And I was a little fearful that if, you know, this mentality prevails, you know, familiarity breeds contempt, then I'll start making mistakes and create offenses. So I thought, I need a break. And then Tamal Krishna Maharaj came on the party as the permanent secretary. Then Prabhupada got really sick. So I didn't say anything until, you know, after Prabhupada looked like he was recovering a little bit. But when he got sick, then the whole schedule went out the window. And then from that time on, you know, everything changed. And he never got back to his old schedule again. Because his body actually was on its last legs, basically. You know, he was, he'd pushed himself so hard for so many years that his body just collapsed, basically. That's what happened. You know, his kidneys weren't working anymore. And, you know, all of his organs were starting to, you know, diminish. So from that time on, from March 77, then the whole schedule became completely different. So, but, you know, whilst it was, and his Leela changed. And I remember writing in my diary in February, just before he got really sick, that it seemed to me that Prabhupada was about to change his Leela. You know, from preaching to Nirjana Bhajan. Nirjana Bhajan is the stage when you retire from active preaching work. You hand everything over to your disciples, and then you spend your time, you know, just concentrating on your own bhajan. So I kind of, in my diary, I had speculated that I think, you know, Prabhupada may be changing his Leela. because there were some signs, you know, of that illness coming on. I think probably all the time I was with Prabhupada, he was sick with something, you know, either his kidneys or his heart palpitations, high blood pressure, cough and cold. You know, there were so many different things that he was contending with. And by the end of 76, it was becoming apparent that Prabhupada was, you know, starting to actually weaken considerably. When I joined him in 1975, in November, December, when we were in Vrindavan, he was going out for his morning walk. He would go out for an hour, and he would, you know, stride very strongly. We were young men, and we would struggle to keep up with him, you know, his pace. He would walk out very energetically, half an hour out, and then half an hour back. But a year later, when we were in Vrindavan, November 76, Prabhupada was in the habit of going up onto the roof of his quarters, you know, to take his rest after breakfast and after lunch. So there's a stairway that goes up onto the roof. So I was following Prabhupada up one morning, and I was always cautious when Prabhupada was going up and downstairs. I would always be either just behind him when he was going up, or just in front of him when he was coming down, just in case, you know, there were any mishaps, if he tripped up or something. So I was following him up the stairs, and just as he got to the top, I could see he was really straining to get up the last couple of steps, and he had his cane with him, and he was really pushing on his cane, you know, to get up on the last couple of steps. And he got up there, I was behind him, but he made it. So I didn't, you know, kind of touch him or anything. And then he turned round to me and he smiled. And he said, "Now I am an old man." But a year before, when we were in his room, we'd been talking after class. And I figured out what he was talking about, you know, just general stuff that we're not this body. And then at one point when Prabhupada stood up to go for his breakfast, he kind of, you know, stood up very energetically. He was smiling like he was effulgent. And he said, "I am not an old man." He said, "I will never grow old." But then a year later, when we're going up the steps, then he turned to me and smiled again. And he said, "Now I am old." So that was coming. And there were a couple of incidents when we had done, we had gone to Jagannath Puri, 25th and 26th of January. And we had visited, on the 26th evening, we had visited one of the temples of his godbrother, Dr. Shyamasundar Das. This man, he used to send Srila Prabhupada sometimes some few grains of Jagannath Prasadam. He would send that in the mail. So Prabhupada was corresponding with him occasionally. So when we went to Jagannath Puri, Prabhupada decided to go and visit with him. So we went to their mutt. And the Gaudiya mutts, they have the temple, and then they have, in front of that, separate, they have a kirtan hall. So we were in the kirtan hall. Prabhupada was sitting down on, you know, cotton gaudy. They were talking for a few minutes. There were a few devotees there. The Namhata party were there. This was the old collecting party of Guru Kripas that used to go to Japan. So they were all there. And when Prabhupada finished talking, then he started to get up. So he was sitting down cross-legged. So what he did was he brought his legs up with his knees up in front of him, put his feet flat, still sitting, and then he got his cane and he grasped the cane with both hands and started to kind of haul himself up using his legs and his hands. So he got halfway up, and then just momentarily I saw him, you know, kind of hesitate and stop. And I was just thinking, maybe I should help Prabhupada, you know, to get up. And then he just dropped back on the mat again. So, you know, it was kind of a surprise to everybody that he wasn't able to even get up from sitting position. So from that time, because I regretted not having come forward and lifted him up when I saw that he was struggling. So then after that, I made, you know, a mental decision that whenever Prabhupada had to go up steps or, you know, get up like that, that I would just automatically help him and make sure that he got up, because now he doesn't have the strength. So later on we went to Mayapur, and we did a program in February. I just forget the date now, but we went to Mahesh Pandit's Samadhi, which is in a village a couple of hours from Mayapur towards Calcutta. So we there was like a pandal that had been arranged there, small one. There was a man there, he was the Saivite, and he had invited, you know, Prabhupada to come there. He wanted ISKCON to actually take over the worship of the deities. He still had the original deities, either Gaur Gadadhar or Gaur Nittai of Mahesh Pandit. Mahesh Pandit's mentioned in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So we went there, and then for the pandal, we had to go to this field. And there was a stage structure. It was a brick platform, actually. And, you know, Prabhupada had been invited to go. There was a seat put up on the platform. So it might have been, you know, about head height, the level of the platform. And there were some steps, wooden steps at the side. And they were quite steep. So I saw Prabhupada headed towards them, and I thought, well, you know, this is going to give him some trouble. So I tucked in right behind him. And as Prabhupada went up one step, I went up the step behind him. So I was just literally one step behind all the way up. And I had my hands out just behind his shoulder, armpits, but not quite touching him, but just in case. And Prabhupada was, you know, he was going up one step at a time. I mean, normally, you know, you do left leg, right leg, up like that, one step at a time, with using one leg on each step. But he was pushing himself up onto one step, getting both feet on, and then pushing himself up onto the next step, getting both feet up, like that. So he got to the last step, and then I saw he was pushing with his cane. He put his left leg up, and he was trying to get his right leg up, and he was pushing with his cane, and it was wobbling, the strain. And he couldn't do it. And just at the moment when he let go of his... Well, he didn't let go of the cane, but, you know, he kind of would have fallen back. I just caught him under the armpits, and I literally lifted him up onto the stage. The Prabhupada didn't say anything. He just walked off to the to the seat and sat down and, you know, acted like everything was normal. Then later on, we visited the mutt of Srila Sridhar Swami, Prabhupada's godbrother, B.R. Sridhar Swami. He had invited Prabhupada because he had come to see Prabhupada in our temple in 76. So in reciprocation, Prabhupada went to see him at his temple. So when we went there, he mainly stayed up on the top of his temple, and he had to go up some steps to get there. So Sridhar Maharaj went up, Prabhupada followed him, and I was following right behind Prabhupada again. Again, the last couple of steps, he was really straining and practically hesitating. And I had offered, you know, to get a chair and we would carry him up on the chair. But Prabhupada said, no, it's all right. So he went up. He just made it. He just got to the top step. I could see he had no strength left at all, but he just made it. Then we came on the flat roof. I thought, you know, okay, this is fine. No problem. However, the roof was divided by a wall, which was about head height. And there was, you know, like a little gateway or opening through the wall in the middle. But that was raised up. And there were three steps that you had to climb up to get up to go through the gap in the wall and down the other side. So Prabhupada just, you know, kept on walking. He got up the first step, same method. You know, put one leg up and then pushed with his cane to get the back leg up onto the step. Then again, next step, put his left leg up. Then again, push with the cane to get onto the next step. And he got his leg off the ground, but he just didn't have the strength to get it up onto the step. And he just fell. But I was right behind him, standing on the first step, and I just, again, caught him under the armpits and just lifted him up and put him on the top step. Prabhupada walked through the gap down the other side, didn't say anything. He didn't look behind, nothing. He just kept on going. But I could feel that, you know, he was very satisfied with the fact that I was there and that he could rely on me, not, you know, that he wouldn't fall. He had that confidence. So he just kept on going. He never said a word. But anyway, whilst we were in Mayapur then, during that month, that was an indication of what was going on. And one afternoon when I was giving him his massage, Prabhupada told me, he shook his head, he said, "Never in my life have I felt as weak as I do now." So, you know, he was aware that it was coming to the end. His body was wearing out and there was nothing that could be done about it. But he just kept on with his schedule as much as he could. And then just shortly after that comment was made, that was when he got really sick. And he never really recovered from that sickness. So his entire schedule then, you know, was totally changed. So your question was that, you know, Prabhupada was very regulated and, you know, he did these kinds of austerities like translating in the night, sleeping 3 hours or 4 hours at the most a day. So, you know, how do we view that in terms of our own practices? So the thing is not to imitate. You know, Prabhupada used to tell us that you have to get your rest. So if you need 6 hours, 7 hours, then you have to take that. You can't imitate and pretend that you can get by on 3 hours, you know, and then after a week, then suddenly collapse, you know. If you can actually do it, then you can do it. Just like when I came to see Prabhupada in May of 77, I had left the party in March, and Prabhupada sent me back to be the GBC in Australia. So then, in May of 77, Prabhupada had been in Rishikesh, and then he got really, really sick. It was an emergency. They rushed him back to Vrindavan, and the word went out to all the GBCs that they had to immediately come to Vrindavan because Prabhupada may be leaving. So we all went there, but I got the message a couple of days after everybody else because I was a new GBC, and some of the GBCs didn't even know that I was a GBC, so I never got the message. I came in a little bit late, and Prabhupada had started to recover a little bit. So then I thought, now I'm here, I may as well stay for a couple of weeks. All the other GBCs practically were already leaving by the time I got there. So we were having shifts. Somebody had to be with Prabhupada all the time, day and night. So one evening I went up, it was my shift. And actually when I got back to Australia from India, I had a reoccurrence of a malaria attack that, you know, I caught malaria a couple of times in India, and I'd gotten this medicine and it had kind of suppressed it, so I was functioning, but it had not actually flushed it out of my body. So when I went back to Australia, after about a month, I guess the change of climate and everything, it just reactivated this malaria. So I got really sick. I was put in the hospital for about 4 or 5 days. Tropical Diseases Hospital. I couldn't eat or anything, and I lost a lot of weight. But then after that, then I've been reading in the Bhagavatam where Prabhupada said, I think in the 7th canto, that if one is serious about spiritual life, then he only eats once a day. So I thought, okay, you know, I'll try that. So I was only eating one meal a day. So when I came to see Prabhupada in May, at the end of May, you know, Prabhupada was lying on his bed. He would practically, he had already himself, you know, was almost leaving us at that time. You can imagine his condition was very sick. But when I came and sat next to him, he kind of glanced over at me and he said, "So, in Australia, you are reducing?" So I couldn't quite catch what he meant. So I said, "Reducing, Srila Prabhupada?" He said, "Yes." He said, "In Australia, you are reducing?" Then I realized he was talking about my body and I'd lost some weight. So I said, "Oh." I said, "Well, you know, I had malaria, so I got a bit sick." So, you know, and then I said, "But I'm only eating once a day now." So then Prabhupada said, "No." He said, "If you're sick, then you should eat." So then I said, "Well, I read it in the Bhagavatam where it says that if you're serious about spiritual life, then you only eat once a day." So he said, "Oh, then that is all right." So, you know, because I had a Shastric reference, it was, you know, bona fide. So, but not whimsically. That's the point. So Prabhupada was always very concerned that we do things, you know, according to our capability and the level of our understanding. And he didn't like it when devotees did things artificially, you know. And that applies for other areas of sadhana, like some devotees, when we first went to Vrindavan, you know, they would go off to Radhakund. And they'd stay at Radhakund for a month or something to chant. Prabhupada got furious about it. He was furious. There was one devotee, Prithu Putra. He had gone and there was some Babaji there. His name was Krishnadas. And he used to like to invite Prabhupada's disciples to come and stay at his ashram. So this boy, Prithu Putra, he had gone there. And he'd stayed there for about a month or so. Then Prabhupada came to Vrindavan and he heard that Prabhupada had come, you know, to the temple. So he came back. So Prabhupada had been informed that he had been living in Radhakund. So when he came, Prabhupada saw him in the courtyard and he stood up and he chastised him in front of everybody. Why are you going and living in Radhakund? Like this. And he told him, he said, you're living like a monkey. You're simply jumping over. And he ordered him to come immediately back and move back into the temple. He didn't like it that he was living in Radhakund because he was not advanced enough to live in Radhakund. If you go and live in Radhakund, you know, that is when you're at the very peak of devotional service. Because devotees, you know, they were reading Nectar of Instruction. And, you know, that glorifies Radhakund as being the best place to perform your sadhana. But Prabhupada pointed out, you know, that's the last verse. The first verse says when you can control your tongue, belly and genital, then you're fit to make disciples all over the world. So he said, first of all, fulfill that, you know, obligation. Then you can go to the point of living in Radhakund. Otherwise, if you go and live in Radhakund, you'll simply chant, eat, sleep, think of women and sex, that's all, and money. As many of the Babajis do there. They smoke beedis, they have 3 dozen widows that they're having sex with, and making out, you know, their big Babajis. It's very dangerous. Radhakund is not different from Radharani. It is only for the most elevated persons. So that's an example, you know, of going beyond one's sadhana. So Prabhupada was very concerned that we do what we're capable of doing. That's all. Not that you should immediately try to emulate, you know, the highest devotees. We were just reading about chanting when I was in Ljubljana. And I'm sorry, when I get talking, it's difficult to stop. So there was one devotee, his name was Sharma. He was a black African devotee. Actually, he was an American devotee, but he'd been preaching in Africa. So there was some disturbance in the African yatra and he got fed up. So he came to India in late 75. He came to see Prabhupada in Vrindavan and he just wanted to chant. That was his whole thing. He wasn't going to do anything except just chant, because when he was chanting, then his mind was peaceful. And if he was doing any other service, then he was disturbed. So he wanted to just chant. So Prabhupada wasn't happy with that, but he saw this boy's very disturbed. So if I tell him no, then he may go away. So he gave him permission to go to Mayapur and chant. So off he goes. This is late 75 from Vrindavan. Early 76, Prabhupada comes to Mayapur. So Sharma's still there. He's living out at the Goshala. So one day he comes over to see Prabhupada. And, you know, he explains he's chanting 150 rounds a day. I mean, that's a lot of rounds. You know, even Haridas Thakur was only doing 100 rounds a day, or what, 3 lakhs of names, whatever. Anyway, he was doing 150 rounds a day. And he was just eating the remnants of the food that was left over after the other devotees had taken their meals. So like this, he was trying to be very renounced, just, you know, absorbed in the holy name. So then he came to see Prabhupada and he wanted permission to build a tree hut. And the reason why he wanted to live up in the tree was because he said, when I'm chanting, then different devotees come and see me, and it disturbs my chanting. So Prabhupada said, you want to live like a monkey, that's all. He said, you're chanting, but now you want to go and live in a tree. He said, that means that you're not fit for chanting, because you're becoming disturbed. It just means that you have a disturbed mind, that's all. So Sharma goes back and, you know, keeps on. He doesn't build his tree hut. But then about a week later, he comes back again. And by this time, the festival had begun. So now there were hundreds of devotees, about 500 or 600 devotees had come from the West. And so again, he came to Prabhupada, and now he asked, he said, I'd like to go, I want to go and chant in Radhakund. He said, because, you know, so many devotees are here now, and it's disturbing me, and I can't get my rounds done properly. So then Prabhupada shook his head. He said, first of all, you wanted to live in a tree. Now you want to go and live in Radhakund. He said, this means that you are not fit for chanting. He said, like Haridas Thakur, he was living in a cave, and there was a huge snake that was living in the same cave with him, but he was not disturbed. He was just chanting. He said, this means that you are not fit for Nirjana Bhajan. He said, you know, factually, he said, your mind is too disturbed, you shouldn't be doing this. So Sharma went off. Prabhupada didn't give him an instruction to stop, but later on, Sharma sent a message through the secretary that he'd decided to go back to Africa and preach, because he could see Prabhupada wasn't satisfied with what he was doing. Then later on, Prabhupada got a letter from him in September, about the 27th of September in 76. He sent it from Nairobi. And then it was a whole thing again about how, again, he was being disturbed, and he just wanted to make his service chanting and live in Vrindavan and, you know, think about Krishna's pastimes. And then somehow or another, you know, if he could please his spiritual master and Krishna, then he could become a servant of the serving maids of Vrindavan. This was his sentiment. The gopis who become, you know. So, you know, he asked again permission to make just chanting, you know, his main service. So then Prabhupada again wrote back to him, same thing, that, you know, you were chanting in Mayapur. Why did you leave? You know, if you're so expert at chanting, then why did you leave? Said, this means that you're not fit for such chanting. After that, we never heard from him again. At least I never heard from him again. I don't know what happened to him, whether he stayed in Africa or he went somewhere else, but that was it. We never heard anything from him again. So the point is that, you know, Prabhupada would encourage us, yes, chant more rounds if you can chant more rounds. But when somebody was doing it artificially, he didn't like that. So you have to do, you know, what you're capable of doing. That's the whole point. Last example. It's very late. The last example is a simple one. We were in Detroit in 1976. And Shrutakirti Prabhu, who had previously been Prabhupada's servant for many years, at least 2 years, he was there. He had come with Ambarish Prabhu. And Prabhupada had previously written to them, giving them permission to start a restaurant. So Ambarish wanted to buy a property in Boston, and Shrutakirti Prabhu was going to work with him and be the chef and run the place. So they came to see Prabhupada in Detroit. And it was the first time, actually, that Shrutakirti and I had met, at least since I had been Prabhupada's servant. So it was nice, you know, he was one of the older servants. I was the new boy. And so we had a, you know, it was nice. Anyway, so they came. And they were talking with Srila Prabhupada in the morning, and then it was time for massage. So I walked in the room, you know, with my gumsha on, and I had the oils, and I had Prabhupada's gumsha. So in those days, I was kind of quite, you know, strongly built. So Shrutakirti looked up, and he said, oh, he said, Hari Sori looks like he could give a good massage. So Prabhupada smiled. He said, yes, he said, he is your duplicate, except in cooking. He knows very good cooking. Because I had twice tried to cook for Srila Prabhupada when we were in New Zealand and then Hawaii, and I completely blew it both times. And Prabhupada was completely disgusted with what I'd done. He told me, he said, your brain is too dull. He said, you will never learn how to cook. So... he threw this in when Shrutakirti said, "Oh, he looks like he could give a good massage." Then Prabhupada said, "Yes, he's your duplicate, except cooking." He said, he knows how to cook very well. He's being sarcastic. So then Pushya Krishna, he kind of threw in a crack of his own. He thought he'd join in with the joke. So he said, "Yeah, but he knows how to eat very well." You know, because I had a big appetite. But then Prabhupada immediately changed his mood and he said, "No," he said, "a young man," he said, "why should he eat like me?" Meaning, I don't eat hardly anything because I can't eat anymore, you know. But he's a young man, he should eat. So like that, you know, you have to, you know, as it says in Bhagavad Gita, not too much, not too little. Not too much sleep, too little sleep. Everything has to be according to your capacity. And at the same time, you have to make some advancement. That means that you have to push yourself a little bit. Yeah, but don't push yourself so far that you crack. That's the point. Does that answer your question? All right, so it's 9:30. I have to get up very early. I've got a plane to catch tomorrow morning to split. When am I coming back here, actually? Does anybody know? What date am I coming back here? Alright, so I'm coming back in the morning on the 31st. Okay, anyway, I'll be back for a couple of days, 31st, 1st, and I think maybe the morning of the 2nd, yeah? So, you can come again, we'll talk about some other pastimes. We've finished book writing. Maybe when I come back, we'll talk about prasadam or cleanliness, one of those things. Okay, and one last thing, just give me that book. Because all the material that I've been discussing, that's all been written down in different volumes of this book, A Transcendental Diary. This is the diary that I was keeping when I was traveling with Prabhupada. But naturally, this is much bigger. I mean, the original diary were just some notes that I was keeping every day. What I did was expand those notes so that, you know, they're intelligible. And then I took all the recorded material. You know, we were tape recording Prabhupada. So morning walks, conversations, things like that. I took all that material. And then I obtained from the archives all of Prabhupada's letters, the letters that were written to him, as well as his replies, and I combined those three sources to make this book, A Transcendental Diary. So this gives a day-to-day account of Srila Prabhupada's activities from November 75, and it will eventually get to March 77. This is the newest volume, Volume 5. This covers from October and November of 1976. So that's Aligarh, Delhi, Chandigarh, and Vrindavan. About 5 weeks in Vrindavan. So, in fact, there'll be two more volumes after this one, and then that will complete that series. I'm working on the sixth volume now. So if anybody's interested, they're available in the shop there. Otherwise, Sundarananda Prabhu, if you run out, you can get more from Vishnumurti Prabhu. He's my distributor in Europe. So if you'd like to read more about these things, all of these topics are there, and everything that I've been talking about basically is in these volumes of Transcendental Diary. So if you get the inclination at some point, read about Srila Prabhupada, because when we hear about Srila Prabhupada, as I said at the beginning, then we know what is the Bhagavatam. Then we know what it means to be a devotee. We know how to act as devotees in all different kinds of circumstances and conditions of life. And that's really the, you know, the valuable lesson that Prabhupada gave us. He wasn't just speaking, but he was doing, you know. He wasn't just translating and commentating on the Bhagavatam, but he was living the Bhagavatam. So that's very important for us to have that example to understand, you know, how to be devotees. So that's it. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.